pilot saw her, but her gaze did not linger. Good, Chess thought. Maybe she's learned her lesson. Maybe she understood that Chess wasn't afraid to shoot at her heart next time. Chess had come to the palace to rescue a new Republic pilot and build a plan to escape Katadra and destroy the 204th. Instead, she'd found a blaster and a shadow wing pilot and nothing more. She was getting impatient with her progress, but she was developing a new plan. Groiver continued introducing Chess to most every cultist in the palace, and though that left her busier than before, she was now trusted. She had a room of her own, a tiny, unpainted stone cell. She'd been invited to take part in the garden planting the following month. A small child had taken to giving her presents, little sculptures of bent wire representing Katadran animals. Chess didn't have the heart to reject these and lined them up against her cell wall. Most significantly, she'd been able to steal a radio so she could listen to subspace static on concealed headphones during Ledich's daily lectures, awaiting a signal from the New Republic or Imperial reinforcements, or whatever she could get. The third time she encountered the prisoner was that same evening, on her way back to her cell to lounge and plot. She passed the TIE pilot in a palace corridor, and the woman moved surprisingly swiftly, despite the burn marks and bruising and limp. She planted her feet on the marble, adjusted her stance, and jabbed a crutch into Chass's nose before Chass realized she was under attack. The medics rushed toward them as they scuffled and fell. Chass was attempting to pound the woman's head against the marble floor when her adversary leaned up, teeth close to Chass's ear.
"You know about Shadowwing?"
the woman hissed. The last time she'd spoken, Chass had chalked up the hoarseness in the woman's voice to fatigue and injury. Now she heard something new, a hitch of static. Maybe a medical vocabulator?
"Yeah,"
Chass grunted.
"You were at Pandem Nai,"
the woman said. The medics were trying to pull Chass away. The woman clamped her teeth on Chass's earlobe, released, and whispered,
"I know where to find a ship."
When they parted ways, Chess was bleeding profusely. The pilot met her gaze and bowed her head in a gesture that seemed almost submissive. Groiver visited Chess in the medical suite while her nose was bandaged by the attendants. They checked her horns for damage with an expertise Chess could grudgingly admit, if only to herself, that she'd never experienced in the New Republic.
"Does your species require any additional care?"
one attendant asked, and Chass almost snorted in reply. The sudden sharp pain and rush of salty blood into her throat turned the sound into a gurgle.
"Aren't there people on the street who need treatment more?"
Chass asked Groiver when the attendants moved away. She spat a wad of blood and phlegm onto the marble.
"Anyone outside is welcome to join us, but we can't force them,"
Groiver answered.
"Your medics could go to the people of Katadra instead of promising Bacta as a recruitment bonus."
She tried to keep the disgust out of her tone. She didn't want to lose Groiver's trust, but she didn't try hard. The scarred man laughed anyway. He seemed to laugh at just about anything.
"You're ornery when you're injured, Maya. I can't speak for Ledich, for she speaks for the Force. But she always says the health of the Fellowship, of the community, is what matters most of all."
"In that case, why'd you rescue me? Why'd you grab—"
she almost said the Shadow Wing pilot.
"The imp.
Have you spent much time on Katadra? Just because we don't walk into a riot or a holy war doesn't mean we have no mercy. And you keep the imp under guard because—"
Groiver smiled brightly and wiggled a finger at Chess's nose. This time she laughed, a quick, humorless bark. She wondered how many cultist limbs the woman had broken. Groiver shrugged and offered his arm to Chess as she stood up from the examination table.
"She told the man who found her that her name was Lieutenant Palal Sidia," Groiver said.
They walked alongside each other out of the medical suite and back toward the palace living chambers.
"That's about all she says. Ledich says to welcome her, so we welcome her," You should welcome her. Set an example. An example of what? What the future could look like. Rebels and Imperials working together and moving past their grudges to be part of something bigger. Chess smirked and prodded the bridge of her nose, sending a jolt of pain into her skull. So we're definitely not hostages for you to use when whoever's running the system takes a closer look at your operation? Do you want to leave, Maya? Groiver stopped abruptly and turned to face her. You're no hostage. You can leave if you must. Tone it down, she told herself. Childhood trauma. Bad cult when I was young, remember? I do, Groiver said. Maybe Palal Cedia brings back other bad memories, too. You think about your friends from the New Republic? She'd never talked about friends, Maya's or Chas's. She thought of Nath Tenzin's face, caught a flicker of Will Lark, and pushed it all down before the worst of them rose up in her brain. They weren't my friends, she said. Everyone had friends before they found the Fellowship. Know that you have family now. But if there's anyone we should watch for, anyone you wish us to haul to safety if we find her floating in the void, you need only say the word. The name Chas didn't want to remember rose up again. The woman who had stolen her trust, lied to her, earned her loyalty, and let her down. If you see Erica Quell, if she's still alive, then you kill her. She blinked away a sting in her eyes. The words came out without thinking. I knew a woman named Kairos. I don't know if she made it out, but she deserves better than to die in a stasis tube. Of course, Groiver said. Of course. Groiver's urging to set an example made it easier to meet the Imperial without drawing attention. The next morning, Chas cornered her in a dusty, half-collapsed corridor that smelled like pipe smoke. Once again, Chas threatened to kill the woman. Cedia listened patiently to Chas's lavish descriptions of evisceration before asking,
You'll wait to settle our differences on the outside?
You said you have a ship? Chas asked. If Cedia had been part of the attack, if she'd killed Alphabet Squadron and Riot Squadron and Hound Squadron, then she would die. But if she could lead Chas to the rest of the people who needed killing, so much the better.
The cultists thought I was unconscious when they brought me here. I was not.
The woman's vocabulary whined like an insect. She didn't seem to notice.
I know where they keep their vessels. I can't get there on my own, though. Not with these.
Chas eyed the crutches. We climbing somewhere?
I need access codes, or grade 4 explosives. Normally I would steal one or both. Under the circumstances...
I get it, Chas scowled. She could rig a basic bomb if she sacrificed her blaster's battery and scavenged parts from the kitchens and the bathrooms. But grade 4 meant they were going through something thicker than a standard blast door. Whose access codes?
I'm not certain. I assume even the holy vessel of the Force needs a code cylinder.
She spoke with such disdain that Chas smiled despite herself. Nothing ever came easy. Chas learned the name of the child who insisted on giving her toys, Nikita, and she discovered where the palace corridors dead-ended in unpainted granite or mounds of rubble. She sought in vain for a cultist who dealt in contraband or one who could grant her access to heavier weaponry. She located a crypt used by whoever had built the palace centuries before and found the solitude there peaceful. She saw the cultists attempt to welcome Cedia as they'd welcomed her. The Imperial began to take meals with the others, reluctantly spearing fried beetles before stalking away. The cultists endeavored to make conversation each time, asking Cedia what she thought of the food or if she liked the clothes left for her, nothing that touched on matters personal or political. Usually Cedia ignored the speakers altogether. Once, however, when Nikita offered the pilot one of her bent wire toys, Cedia whispered something to the girl and sent her away bawling. Chas saw the exchange from start to finish, and something turned in her gut. She made a note to kill the woman slowly. The next time Lettage lectured to the cult, Chas removed her headset and listened.
"How many of you?"
the fungus-faced hologram began.
"Sought to destroy yourselves before coming to the children. How many of you indulged in practices, knowingly or unknowingly, that could only have led to your doom?"
The woman smiled with gentle humor.
"Did you toil, obedient to droids you believed you owned? Did you steal and deceive so that you could earn credits for spice and death sticks? Did you fight, claiming to yourself that it was for a worthy cause? Look at your neighbors. They did the same. There's no shame in this galaxy, except the shame of self-deception. There's no reason to carry with you the burden of your past or the burden of dreams for the future. With the children of the empty sun, there is no future."
That's the most honest thing you've ever said, Chas thought, and shifted on her blanket in the common area. One of the cultists, no one she knew, rested his head against her shoulder.
"The Jedi Order tells stories about men with great destinies whom the Force chooses for terrific deeds. But the Force doesn't desire greatness. The Force desires simplicity and life and love. The children of the empty sun may one day spread across the galaxy, but as individuals, we will rise every morning and sing and eat and raise our children according to the laws we have deciphered from cosmic truth. There are no criminals among us, no paths to doom, nor are there heroes."
The lecture went on for a very long time. Afterward, the cultists gathered for their thrice-weekly disquisition, in which small groups sat in silence until, one by one, the attendees rose and spoke about whatever the Force moved them to speak. Usually these little speeches were confessions of sins, major or minor, from various points in the speaker's lifetime. To Chas, the whole affair looked an awful lot like a way to gather blackmail material. She expected there were recording devices in all the disquisition rooms, ready for Lettage and her attendants to review. She'd seen similar scams elsewhere and thought, as scams went, it was a pretty good one. Today, Groiver talked about his daughter, whom he'd abandoned along with her mother years earlier. A pale child admitted he'd been eating raw Nectros crystals despite the cult discouraging sweets. A tusked Aqualish spoke at length in a language that Chas didn't understand. He was applauded and embraced when he finished. Chas searched for something to talk about in case she was asked to share, something appropriate to the life she'd built for Maya Halleck. The confessions went on. No one even looked at her. Lieutenant Palal Cedia rose from the auditorium's bottom tier on a single crutch. Chas hadn't seen her, hadn't recognized her in civilian garb instead of her flight suit. Her electronically enhanced voice reverberated through the room, distorted by echoes.
"I executed a planet," Cedia said. "I was part of Operation Cinder, and I accept personal responsibility for the cleansing of Necronus."
The cultists shuffled in their seats, but no one interrupted.
"I don't think of that as the worst thing I've done,"
the pilot went on.
"Many people would disagree. I assume the New Republic would hang me for it, probably after giving me as humiliating a trial as they could manage. But I was raised to believe in duty and obedience to those who uplifted and privileged me. I can't bring myself to believe that obedience is ever truly wrong. At worst, it's like a solar flare, bad news in the wrong circumstances, but not possessed of agency. You don't hang a sun for incinerating a passing freighter. That said, I've done many things I am ashamed of. I left my twin sister in charge of the estate when I promised my father I'd care for it and pass it on to my children. I've made errors on missions that cost lives, and I..."
Cedia paused and looked around at the crowd. Her voice fell.
the worst thing I've ever done, the thing I feel most guilty about, that I've done more than once. I didn't tell my friends I loved them when they went on a mission to die. Not because I was scared, or not because I was scared. Because it seemed undignified. So they died without knowing.
Cedia sat down. Scattered applause sounded before silence resumed. What the hell was that? Chas thought, though she had a good guess. Chas met with Cedia that night in one of the palace gardens. Even through her broken nose, the smell of mulch was almost overwhelming.
The ancient Tangradidae general, Mardrun, called it crossing the threshold of the mirror,
Cedia said. What?
The moment when you've seen the face of your foe. When you've gotten so close, learned so much about each other, that whoever moves first is bound to win.
The TIE pilot sounded disinterested, as if she were explaining something rudimentary.
It's a dangerous time, but the gravest peril is to wait too long, to believe you've not yet arrived at the threshold when you already have. You risk going from understanding the enemy to becoming the enemy.
Chas wasn't a fool. She understood. Mostly. The cult or us?
You tell me,
Cedia said.
I tried to earn their trust today, but you saw the result. They're brainwashed idiots and provincial yokels, but they're not entirely stupid.
At least they don't go around killing planets, Chas snapped. They watched each other a while.
You're the one with the blaster and working legs,
Cedia said.
If we don't get the access code soon, I suggest we take hostages.
Chas wrinkled her nose as the bandage tickled her skin. I can get the access codes, she said. Then you die or I die, and the winner gets the star system. 2. The Cerberon sky was dazzling after so long spent underground. The stars bled together into shining clouds, too dense and bright to do otherwise. No electric lanterns or neon signs tarnished the heavens' clarity. The only sources of illumination at ground level were twinkling indicators on droids and repulsor cars, and the distant blue-green fires that rose from the cracked landscape of pitted metal plains and blasted canyons. It's beautiful, Will Lark murmured, his hand resting on T5's top module. A flight of ships crept overhead from the direction of the city.
They're heading for our target, you know, Nat said.
I know.
Will felt an unexpected flash of irritation, though he was confident that Nath meant no condescension. He hoped his voice hid his emotions. Despite their spat below the surface, the last thing Will wanted was to alienate his friend.
There's nowhere else they would go, but if they're setting a trap, they're not being subtle about it.
Maybe they figured we wouldn't look up.
Nath shrugged, T5 chimed and vibrated beneath Will's hand, and then Nath continued.
Or maybe they figured there's no turning back for us. We go to the mining facility or we starve to death in this wasteland.
Wouldn't surprise me.
Will surveyed the ruined land around them. The 61st Mobile Infantry was hidden within a ravine as desolate as any asteroid. But where CER-952B had been shaped by meteorite impacts and erosion over millions of years, the Scar of Troyth had been formed by living beings. Its shattered expanse lacked the grandeur of mountains or ocean depths. Instead, it resembled a pane of hardened glass, repeatedly struck by a hammer until cracks covered every centimeter. The continent had been evacuated and strip-mined until it was barren, and then the people of Troyth had kept digging until there was nothing left but chasms and unquenchable flames. T5 squawked louder and wiggled from side to side. Nath looked back to the sky, and Will followed his gaze, spotting three new lights, vessels flying low in the atmosphere, close enough for their howling to be heard.
Droid recognizes the engine signature. Says they're cargo hoppers, Nath said. Looks like the imps are moving in some serious equipment. Could be they thought our plan was too good not to steal.
Will laughed. Someone shouted his name, and he removed his hand from T5.
If our plan was good enough for Shadow Wing, then we must be getting better at this, he said, and hurried to answer his summons.
The commanders met in a circle of dust in the shadow of overhanging rocks. The rest of the company provided them with a modicum of privacy by staying at a distance. But Will still heard boots shuffling in the dust and the low murmur of conversations throughout the ravine. Carver had given orders to stick to the shadows and keep the noise down, yet there was only so much the troops could do to hide their presence.
Good thing they're not actually looking for us, Twitch muttered.
The churlish middle-aged squad leader was cleaning an assault rifle as she squatted in the dirt, paying more attention to her weapon than to the rest of the group.
There's more going on than a scheme to ambush us, Carver agreed.
The sergeant-turned-unit commander looked as if he'd aged over the past days, his skin cinched tight over his muscles.
If we were their top priority, their scouts would be all over the canyons. Hell, they could blow the mining facility apart from the inside and pick us off out in the open.
Then they want the facility for its own sake, Will said.
He glanced around the circle. No one argued. No one spoke. Carver broke the silence.
Come on, people. We wanted it because it could hold up against a siege, give us a place to stage hit-and-run attacks from. So what are the imps going to get from an old mega-facility that they can't find anywhere else?
Junior, the elderly human Will rarely heard speak, shifted awkwardly.
It's a deep-core drilling site. Troyth has an unusual mineral composition. Volatile minerals.
Without turning his head, he flapped a hand in the direction of a column of blue-green flame lighting the ravine from kilometers away.
Maybe they want to blow it up.
Twitch looked up from her rifle.
The whole planet? Maybe, Junior said. Chain reaction? Quake activity? I don't know. Lark,
Carver was scowling.
You were the one who said Shadow Wing wouldn't care about preserving the population. Could that go for infrastructure, too? Any reason to think they'd hesitate to blow a world?
I'm not sure.
It was an honest answer, and better than I hope not.
They were part of Operation Cinder, so yes, they're willing to kill a population.
But if they came to retake Cerberon for the Empire, I don't know if they'd ruin it all out of spite.
Carver spoke over him.
Denying resources to an enemy isn't spite, especially after what happened at Pandem Nye. The 204th worked with us to stop that planet from burning, even when they knew they were going to lose. Whatever the reasons for Cinder, Pandem Nye is the most recent action we can point to.
Twitch snorted.
Not inspiring faith.
Let's not assume they're capable of detonating the core of the planet, Leon Tube said. Like Junior, the Sulliston was mostly an unknown to Will, though she'd struck him as pragmatic in their past meetings.
Imperials are monsters, not gods. We shouldn't confuse what they'd want to do with what they can.
Let's not underestimate them either, Carver said.
The conference splintered from one discussion into several. Carver, Twitch, and the massive hook named Dorgatha, Gorgeous Sue's brother, began sketching assault plans in the dust, debating whether it was too late to take the facility in a frontal attack. Junior began pulling up data, listing the facility's known assets to anyone who would listen, and trying to find precedents for a planet-wrecking bomb. Leon Tube split her attention between Junior and Will, asking questions about Shadow Wing's past strategies and leadership that Will felt unprepared to answer. Even as he spoke to Leon Tube, Will tried to listen to Junior. Most of the mining equipment, the man said, was likely gone from the facility. If the 204th did intend to detonate underground mineral deposits, they would need to bring in heavy machinery.
Could explain the cargo hoppers streaking across the sky, Junior muttered.
It was an intriguing point.
But another item in Junior's equipment inventory nagged at Will's attention. He sat pondering, reluctant to interrupt anyone until the thought boiled over in his brain.
"It's possible they're trying to escape," he said, crisp enough to demand the other's attention.
"Escape what?" Twitch asked.
"They lost their Star Destroyer. Everything we've heard suggests they lost their cruiser carrier, too.
What if they're trapped in Cerberon with us?"
He paused, sucked in a breath, and went on.
"Junior said the facility had a bulk freighter to move ore into orbit. Maybe it's still there. Maybe all Shadow Wing wants is to get out of here after their plan went wrong."
The others glanced at one another. Will saw nothing but skepticism in their eyes.
"Junior," Carver said, "there's really nothing else on the planet that could cart around a TIE wing. Would a mining barge actually do the trick?"
"Probably. Probably and probably," Junior said.
Carver grunted.
"So it's conceivable that our enemies, the same boys and girls who wiped out one world already, who blew up the Lodestar, and who've got a reputation for nastiness and scheming, want to pick up and leave. It's also conceivable that they're looking to cut their losses and fry the whole planet."
"Conceivable it could be both," Twitch added, though no one acknowledged her.
"Tell me, Lark," Carver said. "How much you willing to bet it's one over the other? Because if we hang back and wait, the consequences could be dire."
The sergeant's tone was aggressive, but not challenging. Will expected the man would listen to his answer.
"I wouldn't bet the fate of Troyth on it," Will conceded.
"All right," Carver said, and clapped his hands together. "Then let's make a new plan, the way we always do when things go south. We thought the mining facility would be where we holed up and waited for reinforcements. Turns out, it's our latest target. Almost like we're rebels again, huh?"
"Hope your squadron's ready for action," Twitch said.
So they turned back to drawing landscapes in the dust and studying readouts of the facility, and for many hours, they talked. They discussed ground assaults and the squadron's readiness, and whether the V-Wing and the airspeeders could be armed with heavy ordnance. No one brought up the possibility of Shadow Wing escaping again. Eventually, Will realized what he had to do. There were scouts and guards and soldiers who played cards through the night. Dennis Rave, Prince Pi, Ubellicos, and Vitali had taken to spending their evenings together ever since Gorgeous Sue's death, reviewing Will's latest combat courses or catching up on gossip from friends in the infantry. He brought them together with Nath and outlined the strategy, promising more details once particulars of the ground assault were finalized. He told them to sleep, that the next day would be difficult.
"This wasn't the operation we were expecting," he finished, "but we knew it would come to a fight sooner or later. We'll take them by surprise and show them it's not about the ships. It's about the pilots and the plan."
He wasn't sure he'd convinced them, but they went to bed shortly thereafter. Thus, the camp was quiet when Will climbed out of a rumbler and padded toward one of the fissures off the ravine. The pack slung over his shoulders didn't slow him, though the smell of old leather was mixed with something like ammonia and mold. He clambered over rocks and squeezed between outcroppings, scraping the skin from the back of his neck before he arrived in a broader canyon and increased his pace. He'd considered taking his ship for the journey, but doing so would have drawn attention from friends and foes alike. His mission tonight was a solitary one, and he'd worked out the timing in detail. He had 90 minutes to travel as far from the camp as possible, half an hour to attend to his task, and another 90 minutes to return before the black hole ascended above the horizon and began to rouse the soldiers. Will tried to remember the last time he'd traveled alone on foot through the wilderness, even a wilderness as tainted as the Scar of Troyth, and recalled nothing from his life with the Rebel Alliance or the New Republic. He remembered only home. For so long, his world had been his starfighter and his squadron. He wondered what he'd lost along the way. The solitude weighed heavier the farther he went. There was no wildlife, not even nocturnal animals foraging. He missed the sounds of his companions breathing, the rustle of movement, and the rumble of engines. He briefly directed his attention skyward, to the stars and the trail of cargo hoppers blazing toward the mining facility, but he tripped on the uneven ground and reluctantly lowered his head. He listened to the faint breeze and the distant crackle of mineral fires. He found a slope to ascend and wished he'd brought his gloves as he scaled the boulders. Yet he'd been climbing ridges since his childhood, and this one was no challenge. When he crested the plateau, he kept walking until the shattered land around him appeared infinite and undifferentiated, until it felt as if he would never find his way back to the company. Next, he set his pack down and took out the transmitter. The readout revealed low-level activity across frequency bands, which Will took to be the Imperial ships in conversation, and the background noise of the planetary communications web. He adjusted the settings, opened a comm channel, activated the holo-imager, and placed the transmitter in the dust. He stood over it and spoke. "This is Will Lark of New Republic Unit Alphabet Squadron, attempting to reach the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing," he said. "I am aware this communication is irregular. I am also aware that you know who I am. We've spoken before, at Pandem Nye and in the Auradal Cluster." "You know you can trust me," he thought, but it was a leap he needed his listeners to make on their own. He omitted mention of Blink's message to him over Troyth, though it was Blink he imagined as he spoke. He didn't know why the TIE pilot had warned him, and he didn't dare expose what the Empire might consider treason. "I believe that some of you are tired of fighting. I can count the comrades I've lost battling you. I can count the TIE fighters I've destroyed. I don't want to do it anymore. Not unless I have to in order to protect..." Not the New Republic. Not even home. "In order to protect more people from dying. I'm exhausted. You're exhausted. If you're trying to escape this system, if you want to find a way out of this, let's come to some sort of solution before..." The voice that interrupted Will was low and stern. He recognized it immediately. "Probably best if you stepped away from the transmitter," Nath said. Will turned around slowly, but did not step away. Nath Tenzin stood 5 meters distant, fingering the grip of his sidearm on his hip, and wearing an expression of weary admonition. Past Nath was T5, antenna raised as it observed the scene.
"Tell me you didn't block the message," Will said.
"Could tell you that, but you'd know I lied soon enough."
Nath jutted a thumb back at T5.
"Little junker doesn't have much range, but it's pretty good with a jammer. Got here just in time, too."
"You knew what I was planning?"
"Hadn't a clue. Thought someone should keep track of you anyway."
Will stared at his friend in bewilderment.
"I don't know what you think I'm doing. I'm trying to save people, Nath. Us, Shadow Wing, Troyth, everyone."
"I gathered that. I didn't figure you were turning traitor. But the odds your plan ends well are pretty slim."
Anger seeped up through Nath's calm facade.
"Assuming you don't get shot by the first TIE that comes along, what do you think is gonna happen? There's a war going on."
Will did his best to keep his voice steady. Mirroring Nath's ire gained him nothing.
"Shadow Wing wants a way out. They're trying to get a ship off-world. I heard your theory, I know. And Blink spoke to me above Troyth. It's how I knew it was the 204th. Blink warned me because... I don't know, maybe because of a respect for what happened at Pandem Nye. But he or she or whoever Blink is sent me a message before the jamming started."
Nath looked genuinely surprised for the first time. He blinked the reaction away soon enough.
"Did that message prove useful in any way?" he asked.
"What do you mean? Blink telling you it was the 204th.
Did it save the Lodestar? Did it save Chass and Meteor? Seems it split us up and distracted us instead of doing much good."
Will began to turn away.
Nath shot him a look of warning that made him pause.
No,
Will admitted. But sometimes people fail. We don't assume that means they aren't sincere. There is a real chance here.
I expect there was a real chance in the Auradol cluster, too.
But your friends died there, and the risk is bigger now.
Nath exhaled performatively, raising both hands and starting to cross the distance to Will.
You talk to them, they can kill you. Or get a lead on us, or blow up the whole planet if we're wrong about what they're doing at the facility. You negotiate with them, you invite them to set a trap. Or you finagle a ceasefire that looks good until someone misreads a signal or sours on the situation and takes the first shot. You somehow pull this off, you let them get off-world, you probably get court-martialed for your trouble.
And what do you figure Shadow Wing does next? They go into retire just because you negotiated a ceasefire for a day?
Nath was 2 meters away. Will tensed, planting his feet in the dust. Nath stopped walking.
You never seemed to me a man who'd choose to fight when there were other solutions, Will said. Or a man who'd make war as a matter of principle.
You're a moron,
Nath smiled joylessly.
You think that's what this is about?
I'm out here to slaughter the enemies of the New Republic?
Will curled and uncurled his fingers, glancing to T5 as if the droid's mere presence could calm him. The astromech did not respond. As infuriating as Nath was, what made it worse was that Will didn't understand why, couldn't comprehend how the conversation had gone down this course. Yet he was carried along by the current.
I don't know, he said softly. You've gone out of your way for revenge against Shadow Wing before.
Ugly laughter struck Will like a fist to the gut.
I got justice for my squadron, Nath said. I don't regret that, but it's done. I made the tough decisions because I was a leader. You don't seem to realize what position you're in.
I am saving your sorry butt, brother, from the consequences of your actions. You really want to resolve this thing peacefully? Walk away from the people who blew up the Lodestar, probably killed Quell and Chas. I'm in. I'll follow. It's not my job to set things right this time, and no one ever accused me of patriotism.
The thought of Chas and Quell dead in space, the thought Will hadn't allowed to find purchase in his mind, despite its constant scrabbling, was fire on the back of his neck. Quell, whom he'd lost the chance to damn or forgive. Chas, the last of Riot Squadron, and his only link to the friends no one else survived to remember. What if Shadow Wing had killed them both? What did he owe them? Nath kept talking.
But if you want to walk away without firing a shot, you be prepared to live with it. If Operation Cinder comes around again, if Shadow Wing picks up where they left off, you don't get to have regrets.
During his cold, steady raging, Nath had closed to within a handspan of Will. Will met the larger man's gaze, seeing Saranik and Renunja and burning worlds.
Back at Pandemni,
Nath's tone was suddenly calmer.
I didn't watch out for you like I should have. You called me on it, and you were right to. I'm watching out for you now. You hear me?
I hear you,
Will said. And for the first time, he thought he understood Nath Tenzin. He'd always known Nath was manipulative and ruthless, but also sincere and good-humored. He understood now that Nath was loyal. More loyal in his way than most soldiers Will had known.
I hear you. I'm just not sure it matters.
If they killed Quell, if they killed Chas, if they killed you and Kairos like they killed Riot Squadron, it still wouldn't change what's right. He thought it. He didn't get the chance to say it. The sound of boots crunching on scree drew the attention of both men. They looked to the edge of the plateau and saw several infantry troops scrambling up the slope. Vitali led the way, hair bundled under her helmet and a rifle tucked under one arm.
Answer your blasted comlinks, she cried. Got a skimmer waiting below. We've got to get back to camp now.
What's going on?
Nath asked.
Will shifted his position, blocking the transmitter from sight.
Just picked up a message from friendly guerrillas back in the city. Every TIE squadron out there just changed course, heading directly for Core 9.
Vitali answered.
Whatever it is they're doing, we've got to seize the facility before the whole 204th is on site. Carver's got a plan. So, you in?
Nath looked to Will. Will looked between Nath and Vitali and the cracked wasteland. He shifted his heel back through the dust and imagined snapping up the transmitter, running from the company. But what was the point? He would be on his own, with nothing worth bargaining away. No way to negotiate. His comrades would be left to die alone. He had failed. Like Nath said, he had to accept the consequences.
Let's go, he said.
Chapter 18. That Which You Take With You. 1.
What did you see this time?
I'd rather not say.
I understand. What did you see this time?
Erica Quell squatted in the red dust with her back to the tower, facing the interrogation droid. The machine floated against the black sky like a moon or a battle station, its low hum throbbing in her bones. She did not meet the gaze of its photoreceptor. The stars behind it blurred into a smear, her sight unfocused with exhaustion and apathy.
The day I joined the 204th, she said, when I chose not to run off with the Rebel Alliance, but instead to leave the Academy and stay with the Empire.
It was not the first time you made a similar decision,
the droid said.
No, it wasn't.
Memories flashed across her brain like sparks from a downed power conduit. A final spasm after the vision that had assaulted her. She had gone to the Imperial Flight Academy to become a pilot. To become a pilot so she could fight for Mon Mothma's rebellion. She'd seen other recruits drop out or fail, earn their freedom through guile or incompetence. She'd been offered the chance by a boy once, she remembered his name was Cam, though it took a moment, who'd repeatedly failed his simulator tests. He'd planned to run and he'd wanted to take Quell with him. She'd refused, fearing arrest and execution, and not liking Cam nearly as much as he'd liked her. She couldn't count how many times she'd chosen to stay with the Empire. Chosen not to walk away when she had the chance. The droid's humming rose an octave and oscillated weirdly.
Why do you believe you made that same decision time and again?
Because, she said, and swallowed the next words. Because...
Because what?
The droid repeated. But she didn't answer, and ITO made a sound not unlike a sigh before finishing.
I detect no significant change in the tower's response to your bio readings. You must actively explore your feelings. Passivity and resistance are getting us nowhere.
I'm not resisting.
How often,
the droid said,
did you think of Necronus before Pandem Nai?
She screwed up her face in confusion and disgust. Was it mocking her? The droid went on.
I make no accusations. You knew what had occurred, yet only after Aiden confronted you did you acknowledge it to yourself. And once that was done, a barrier was broken. You began, as you told me, to remember your life with the Empire. We have been addressing the consequences ever since.
So what?
So you are very good at resisting despite yourself.
Give me an hour, Quell said. Then we can start again.
She didn't know how many days had passed, but for a while she'd counted the circuits of the black hole over the horizon. Each time it ascended, her body tensed and she forced herself not to tremble. Her heart rate increased. When the Eye of Cerberon reached the center of the Black Tower's lens, then it was time to sit in the dust and stare at the all-consuming singularity. And be drawn into a new vision.
Time for the interrogation droid to monitor her vital signs and scan the machinery in the tower edifice. The droid had told her that the tower was looking for something, some biological response that would open the door. By rigorous testing and a process of elimination, Erica Quell was determined to produce whatever response the tower required. It was the only hope of escaping the planetoid for herself and Cairn Aiden. So every time the black hole stared through the lens, Quell stared back. Every time, she saw something different. Sometimes it was a memory uncorrupted by time. The stinging detergent scent of her first cadet uniform as she donned it in the brutal light of the academy barracks, certain her bunkmates could see through her bare skin to her brittle bones. Sometimes the tower's offering was fantasy, or revelation, or clairvoyance. The vision of Necronus' death that had first enveloped her, or other visions since then of Necronus' drowning citizens. Or the view from an X-Wing cockpit as rebel forces fled over Tridara and TIE fighters, her TIE fighter, picked off rebels one by one. Sometimes the tower showed the burnt and bloodied faces of the dead, comrades in the 204th, Zion and Tonus and Jadel, or the nameless stormtroopers who'd been blown apart on the shuttle over Abenito on her first real mission with Alphabet Squadron. Sometimes visions blurred together, one after the next. Sometimes one was enough. Always, ITO was there when she emerged.
"The vision is the prompt,"
the droid told her after the third nightmare.
"The emotion is the password, but you must connect with the imagery. You must fully understand the experience."
She was willing, she told the droid. She was trying. After each vision, she spoke of what she'd seen, and the droid questioned her. It didn't feel like therapy at all. The next time she looked upon the eye and the black tower, she saw herself sitting in a repurposed shipping container in Traitor's Remorse, lying to ITO about what she had done at Necronus. She saw the hangar bay of the Star Destroyer Pursuer on the night she'd crept out of bed to repair the acceleration compensator on her TIE. She'd failed to spot the fault before takeoff earlier in the day. She hadn't followed procedure. Never should have been allowed to leave the ship. And she'd be rebuked and punished if she brought it to the ground crew's attention now. But if she could repair it herself, no one would ever know. She saw the face of Net, recognized the crooked jawline of the girl who'd introduced her to the Rebel Alliance and whom she'd promised everything, everything to. She'd joined the Academy for Net. She'd just never gotten around to leaving.
"You were romantically involved?"
the droid asked. "We were teenagers. I was a year younger than her. I wouldn't elevate it to the status of romance."
"But you were close."
Quell squeezed her eyes shut and felt the planetoid's dust sting her lids. "Yes, we were close."
"What did she tell you when she decided to join the rebellion?"
"She didn't. We'd talked about it for a while, but she didn't announce it before she left."
"She didn't say goodbye?"
"No."
"Was that difficult?"
Quell shrugged. She adjusted her position, rising off her bottom to squat on her knees and stave off the numbness. "Everything's difficult when you're that age, but it could have been worse. We weren't talking a whole lot at the time."
"You were fighting, and while you were fighting, this woman departed your home station to fight a war, leaving you only a message. Am I correct?"
"Yes."
"I would imagine you felt somewhat responsible."
Quell winced. Her eyes opened, she blinked away the sand, and she shuffled forward on her knees.
"I would imagine," the droid continued, "that you were afraid you had driven her to depart, and that you felt afraid for her, knowing that you had failed to join her in her venture."
"What's your point?"
"Many would-be rebels failed to ever make contact with an Alliance cell. If you are unaware of her fate, you should consider the possibility that she never had the opportunity to join." Substantial numbers of smugglers who promised to transport prospective rebels were in fact traffickers working for cartels and crime syndicates.
The fingers of her right hand combed through the sand. When she'd palmed enough, she hurled it at the droid. An expanding cloud billowed around the machine as the larger granules fell to the ground. She lacked the strength to do anything else.
"Bastard," she said.
The droid tilted on its axis, readjusted itself, and floated out of the cloud of dust.
"I overstepped,"
the droid said, and its voice was grave.
"I apologize."
Quell dropped to her elbows and rubbed her filthy palm in her hair.
"What was that about?"
she murmured.
"There are connections that I believe would be beneficial if you made,"
the droid said in the same unshaken tone.
"I am concerned about the timeline, and I inappropriately pushed you in an attempt to expedite."
"The timeline?" she said.
"For you, for Cairn Aiden, you have limited time."
"Until we starve to death," she thought. "Until the planetoid drifts so close to the black hole we'll never be able to get out." She nodded brusquely, though she found the excuse a poor one. The droid spoke again a minute later, and the gravity in its voice was replaced by something resembling contrition.
"I have limited time,"
it said. She looked at the gouges in its black paint, the unlit indicators. She remembered what it had said about its faulty memory circuits and its failing power cells.
"I am afraid I will lose all capacity to assist,"
it said. It was no longer contrite. It was confessing.
"We'll get this thing open," Quell said, and forced herself to rise.
The next time she subjected herself to the eye, she saw herself in the hangar bay of the Lodestar, hurling her fist into Cairn Aiden's stomach in a fit of frustration and rage. She saw General Syndulla watching her with an expression of puzzlement and disappointment. On Troyth, she saw the Twi'lek woman cast a glance backward as she fled to aid another squadron that needed her more. Vanguard Squadron, a squadron that wasn't composed of traitors and failures. Quell saw the astromech droid D6L wobbling excitedly, its transparent dome whirring around, its pings joyful as she offered it a crumb, the smallest hint of gratitude for serving her ceaselessly on the Harkrova moon and accepting fault for her failures. She saw D6L burnt and ruined after saving her life on Pandem Nigh, its chassis wrecked and its memory chip the only thing she'd been able to recover. She'd treated D6L unfairly. She'd treated it as a tool, and now she wore its chip around her neck, as if that somehow mattered to the machine that no one but she would remember. Then she'd treated CB9 with disdain, as if D6's replacement were at fault for her old astromech's destruction. CB9 had repaid her by locking her out of her X-Wing when Alphabet Squadron had needed her most, when Shadow Wing had returned. Her bitterness had cost her her droid and her squadron. The visions continued from there. She lay on her back, the cold air washing over her sweat-damp shirt. She ignored the chill and told the droid about the last vision she'd seen. The day she'd broken the painted plate her father had hung by the kitchenette light controls.
"I was 7, maybe, and I'd been running back and forth, and the plate just came down. When he found out, he thought my brother Garrett had done it. He yelled and yelled. He said the plate had been his grandmother's. My father never got angry, but he yelled at Garrett, and I think he was crying. I never told him I did it. I haven't thought about it in years."
"Do you regret not telling him?"
the droid asked. It floated out of view just behind her, its hum low and gentle, almost soothing.
"I don't know."
"How do you feel?"
the droid asked. "Same way I feel about the time our Felix was sick and dying." The tower hadn't shown her that memory. It came unsummoned into her mind. My parents were sure she was in pain, and they were probably right. But I refused to go with them when they had her put down. I got to be angry and self-righteous, and my pet got to die without me.
The droid's voice was soft and soothing.
Say the word.
I feel ashamed, she said.
You were a child,
ITO said.
You were a different being.
I wasn't.
In the years since those experiences, most every cell in your body, every atom, has been replaced and renewed. You have rebuilt yourself, both physically and mentally. You do not need to carry the guilt of prior incarnations.
She rolled onto her elbows in the dust. The droid was almost within reach, and its form blocked her view of the tower.
I've got more than enough guilt for this incarnation, she said quietly, and raked her fingers through the sand.
All the more reason to let go of the distant past, one step at a time, yes?
She nodded carefully, considering the words. The droid's photoreceptor seemed to fix on her.
You are a good man, Cairn Aiden,
it said.
You are far braver than you realize.
The light behind the photoreceptor lens flickered. The droid tilted on its axis and then righted itself.
We have more work to do, she said.
There was no point in drawing attention to the droid's glitching.
We have to get inside the tower.
She saw her mentor. She saw Major Soren Keyes walking beside her aboard the Pursuer for the first time, taking an interest in her she'd feared was neither innocent nor appropriate. In time, she'd been proven wrong about Keyes' intentions, but that day she'd wondered what he would ask of her, and those fears, the image of the Major as a corrupt man, an honorless man, made her skin feel ill-fitting. She saw Major Soren Keyes leading the squadrons at Takashir, burning the hives of the natives for reasons she never heard explained. She saw him on Necronus, trudging through the mire in his flight suit, telling her that they'd lost the war, ordering her to desert her unit and go to the New Republic.
You have the nature of a soldier, he'd told her.
But she could tell ITO none of that. She had lied to the droid and lied to Cairn Aiden. She'd claimed that Soren Keyes was dead, though compared with her lie about the murder of Necronus, it was a mere fib, barely worth a rebuke from New Republic intelligence, barely worth a mention were she ever brought to trial for her crimes. But to tell the truth about Soren Keyes was to admit that she had needed his push to leave the 204th.
If you would do this,
he'd told her, gesturing to the corpse of Necronus.
Then there's nothing that will drive you out.
She would not make that confession.
It was Necronus again,
she told the droid. Her tongue was dry and her head felt heavy. She was dizzy when she stood and stumbled away from the tower.
There has been no significant change in the tower's readings.
Maybe that's because I saw the same thing.
If you are experiencing the same vision, you should be able to apply the lessons we have discussed.
I'm trying, she said.
She marched across the plain, and the droid followed her.
You want me to make connections. You want me to find the links between the visions and give the tower what it's digging for.
Yet you experience the visions at a surface level instead of confronting and integrating their emotional resonance.
You know that because... what?
She whirled and nearly fell, but she bent her knees as if the ground were bucking again and maintained her balance.
I'm not hurting enough. I haven't plumbed all the depths of shame and misery you want me to experience.
She breathed heavily. She stared into a scar in the droid's metal.
I have taken oaths to do no harm to my patients,
the droid said.
Those oaths are not unbending, but they were made solemnly and with clear intent. I take no pleasure in the tower's nature. If the structure was a prize of the Emperor, if it was targeted for destruction by Operation Cinder for that reason, it is a prize only a sadist would treasure. Nonetheless, it is our only means of escape.
Long after the droid's voice faded, she listened for an echo in the soft wind. She couldn't remember the last time she'd eaten. The sockets of her eyes seemed to throb. Physical distress was a shelter from the ocean of the visions. The visions were a shelter from the disintegration of her body.
"I know," she said. "Not your fault the Empire is full of bastards. I'll keep trying."
But she didn't tell the droid about Major Keyes. She hoped her shame would be enough. Net was dead. Chass was dead. Will was dead. Nath was dead. Kairos was dead. General Syndulla was dead. Major Soren Keyes led Shadow Wing and burned the galaxy and never even asked Quell to come home. She snapped out of her vision, certain that she was falling through the burning ring of the black hole. Her body felt beyond hot, as if her skin were ready to blacken and peel away and leave only charred bones underneath. She groaned and rolled on the ground and saw the droid hovering above her, a manipulator extended and its syringe touched with crimson. She hugged herself, rubbing her fingers along her arms until she found the corresponding dot of blood and soreness on her left biceps, opposite the squadron tattoo on her right. She shuddered once, forcing down the pain before asking, "What the hell, droid?"
"The damage to my hardware is now affecting 82% of my systems," the interrogation droid said. "You have made minimal progress. We must accelerate this. The tower does appear to respond to physical pain."
She tamped down her fury. It wouldn't help. She accepted the answer, and they resumed the work. She no longer noticed the rise and fall of the black hole. She would look up, see it outside the frame of the lens, and return to her rest. Or she would find it staring and enter its depths once again, focused on the sins she had repeated over and over. The flaws in her spirit that had brought her to this point and had caused her squadron and her wing and the galaxy so much suffering. ITO had pinpointed those flaws well enough. She knew what she'd done, even if she chose not to confess everything aloud. The droid rationed its serums and chemicals, enhancing her agonies when the tower seemed most responsive. Once, it told her, it had detected an energy surge, but she'd woken screaming at the wrong moment, and the tower's equipment had gone dormant. So they repeated the process time and again. The next cycle, or 100 cycles later, after seeing fresh horrors and waking drenched in sweat, Erica Quell scuttled away from the tower. Driven by instinct to leave the site of her misery, she crawled until she reached the edge of the mesa and thought for a moment of pulling herself over. Not to die, she had no conscious urge for death, but because she wasn't finished fleeing. She let her chin droop over the cliffside and breathed slower as the cool wind washed over her, calming her. The droid's words floated down.
"We must return. You cannot ignore what you see."
She sounded petulant as she asked, "Why?"
"Because it is your only escape off this world."
The voice was the voice she had come to know since Traitor's Remorse, but there was a wrongness to it that made her shudder. She eased back over the cliff's edge and turned to look at the floating sphere.
"My only escape?" she asked.
"Yes," the droid replied.
She repeated the words in her mind, and it felt like another vision, another horror.
"Why do you care whether I escape?" she asked.
"Because you are my patient."
She climbed to her feet and reached out to the droid to steady herself. The metal of its chassis was too warm, as if its components were overheating.
"Fine, but I need to walk it off, or I'm not going to survive to see the lens again."
They moved along the cliffside. Quell did not turn her head to look toward the tower.
"Can I ask you something?" she said. "About you."
"We are not here to talk about..."
"I know, but sometimes it's easier to talk about someone else, even if I'm not talking about someone else. You know?"
It sounded like the sort of thing the droid would want her to say. Too much so, perhaps, but she hoped the hoarseness in her voice and the lurch in her step would give the words the required innocence.
Very well,
the droid said. You remember what you were before you had patience?
Yes.
How did you go from that to what you are now?
I was reprogrammed.
By who?
No one whose name would have meaning to you.
Where?
At an Imperial transitory holding facility in the colonies.
And you were reprogrammed and escaped there alone?
Yes.
She walked on until she felt a chunk of stone catch the toe of her boot. She dropped to a knee and brought her hand to the errant shard. It was in her pocket by the time she was upright. She hesitated to ask the next question. She didn't want to know the answer. Do you know anyone named Cairn Aiden? She asked.
No,
the droid said. She felt the pull of the black hole as if it were looming above her. She thought of the kindness the droid had shown her over the past months. The evening of the victory party after Pandem Nye's fall, when it had called itself her friend. Your memories are gone, aren't they? Wiped or corrupted? Neither of them moved anymore. She faced the unit's photoreceptor, watched the droid tilt on its axis, and then, with a twitch, pull itself level again.
The damage is significant,
the droid said. You're a torture droid again, aren't you? She wished she had her sidearm, or a vibroblade, or even an arc welder. Her hand cupped the jagged stone in her pocket, but next to the machine's serums and sonics and chemical torture turret, she was sorely outmatched. It didn't matter that the droid was damaged. She was damaged too, and probably worse. The droid's voice was lower, taking on a tone of warning.
I no longer serve the Empire, and that is no longer my purpose.
Then why are you torturing me? She cried, louder than the wind. As if in reply, the planetoid rumbled as a quake shook the ground.
Because although I am not a torture droid, I see no reason not to use the tools at my disposal.
You mean no reason to regret?
Nor any reason not to punish an Imperial war criminal for the acts she has committed.
Quell screamed without words as she lunged for the droid. Its humming dropped to a motorized growl, and it descended half a meter, causing her swing of the stone to cut through air. She felt a numbing sonic pulse pummel her right leg and couldn't prevent herself from collapsing, but she fell forward onto the machine, wrapping her arms around its chassis as it attempted to wriggle free. The fingernails of her left hand scraped metal and found one of its scars, her right elbow locked around its secondary manipulator as her right hand brought down the rock, striking at random. She heard a crisp shattering sound and felt something sting her wrist. She suspected she'd smashed the droid's syringe and been stabbed by the glass. The droid became suddenly slick. Her fingers lost their grip on frictionless metal as it exerted its repulsors and rotated its body. A moment later, she felt something burning her left calf and smelled a stench like melting plastoid. She released the droid and saw her pant leg boiling away. She didn't want to think what the skin beneath might look like, but if she was lucky, the garment had taken the brunt of whatever the droid had sprayed her with. The machine was ascending again, attempting to move out of reach, and she knew that if it rose overhead, she wouldn't catch it. She forced herself past the agony in one leg and the numbness in the other to leap, to grasp the droid by a manipulator and yank it back toward the ground. Halfway to the sand, the droid rebounded in midair, and they bounced together toward the edge of the cliff. The droid was saying something, but its voice was distorted, rapidly changing pitch. It dragged her through the dust, and she wrestled it downward, digging her trembling knees into gravel. She struck it with her rock again and drew sparks, struck it once more and saw a panel pop open. But the
then her knees were dangling in the air, and she was slipping over the cliff's edge. She tried to scale the machine and pulled it closer instead. Then one of her arms slipped, the rock fell from her grasp, and she flipped onto her back. Her shoulders and head dangled off the side of the mesa, and the torture droid loomed over her, still clasped by one arm, its red photoreceptor staring at her like the burning eye of Cerberon.
"Aiden," she gasped. "Kairos, nothing?"
"Nothing that would excuse what you've done,"
the droid said, and its voice fluctuated from masculine to feminine with each word. Quell raked her nails over metal as blood rushed to her head. She felt an open socket where the panel had been pried open and tried to hold on as the machine aimed its chemical turret at her face. Something slapped at her nose, and she feared it was the first blast from the turret. Then she saw a dark rectangle flash through her field of vision, and she realized that it was a chip hanging from a short metal chain around her neck. She had moments to act. She used them. She lifted her torso, fighting gravity and her wounded body's weight, and brought herself as close to the droid as she could. She gripped the back of the sphere with one hand, as if pulling it in for a kiss, and snagged the chip with the other, yanking the chain forward and plugging the chip into the droid's open socket. ITO made a noise like a thousand voices overlapping. Quell shimmied forward underneath the machine, letting the chain slip over her head as she returned to the mesa and crawled a meter from the edge. The droid emitted bursts of static and rotated in the air, working its way toward Quell in periodic bursts of speed. Its motions might have been comedic if the unpredictability hadn't been so startling, the implications so horrifying. She had no idea what was occurring in its synthetic brain, whether D6L's memory chip was downloading files like a virus, or whether the broken chip had caused a hardware malfunction the torture droid couldn't circumvent. She felt no triumph at the thought of her old astromech saving her one last time. ITO fell to the dust. Its manipulators twitched like the legs of an overturned beetle. A muffled sound played from its speakers, fragments of her own voice, as if it was searching recorded conversations for what? Some last jab at her? A plea for mercy? An indication of regret? It had forgotten regret and mercy when it had forgotten Kairos and Cairn Aiden. She thought of kicking it off the side of the mesa. The fall would destroy it for sure. She turned away. She hadn't forgotten. She made it to the cave before the next sunless morning. Both her legs were lanced with anguish, but so far as she could tell, the actual damage was superficial. Quakes struck the planetoid twice during her travels, and each time the shaking seemed to drive the pain deeper, yet the effect barely slowed her. She'd suffered enough over the past days. She felt no need to linger on misery anymore. Aiden was where she'd left him. His cheeks were puffy, not gaunt like she'd expected, and his brow was damp with sweat. Wrappers from meal packs danced around the cave in the breeze. She could hear him breathing from several meters away, but she thought he was sleeping, until she knelt beside him and he, barely cracking open his eyes, said,
"You're back."
"Disappointed?" she asked.
"Perpetually," he said.
She scowled and he smiled.
"But that's..."